This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome to Beyond Words Radio, where it's our ambition to move beyond talking about the Christian life and the Bible to living more like Christ. One of the great challenges we face in this country is the influx of religions from other countries. And this is a big topic today. It's not just on the news, it's on our hearts. We wonder what to do about all the Muslim immigrants. And we begin, if we think more, to ponder about where Islam came from. What about their holy book? What about the people who believe in it? What about the history behind it all? If we could get a grasp on these kind of topics, we could better live in this country for the glory of God. And so we have with us Bill Federer. He's an American writer. He's authored over 20 books. His book, America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations, has sold over 500,000 copies. And Bill Federer is radio presence around the country. He's involved in the TCT network, has a daily show. He's got the American Minute. I encourage listeners to check that out. It goes out on the Salem radio network. And Bill, thank you for being with us today.
Well, Dr. Campbell, great to be with you.
And you have recently written a book called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, subtitle, The History of Islam in the U.S. And I thought, wow, what a perfect author to have us unpack and understand better this very important topic for today. So if you don't mind, that's going to be our focus today.
Certainly. Well, it is definitely one of interest because every day there's headlines in the news and Facebook postings about terrorist attacks, and whether it's a Boston bombing, a Fort Hood shooting, San Bernardino killings, Belgium train station blown up. And politicians are quick to assure us that those who committed these attacks do not represent true Islam. Yet in many cases, the terrorists themselves are yelling Allahu Akbar, and they claim they do represent true Islam. The question is, who can tell us what true Islam is? And the answer is one person, Muhammad. And if we examine Muhammad's life, we see it went through three stages. He was a religious leader in the pagan city of Mecca from 610 AD to 622 AD. And he only made 70 converts in 12 years. And he gets confrontational, and the people of Mecca decide to chase him out of town in the year 622 AD for disturbing the peace. He tries going to a city called Al-Ta'if. They don't want him. They pelt him with rocks and stones. And so he has nowhere to go. He is a Muslim refugee. And he goes finally to a Jewish city 210 miles to the north called Medina. Three Jewish tribes control Medina. And they're very nice. They're tolerant. They let Muhammad in as a Muslim immigrant. Muhammad gravitates to the minority neighborhoods in the city. And he begins to organize a following in the community. And then he goes to the Jews and pressures them to accommodate him and his followers politically. The Jews do, and they recognize Muhammad as a political leader in addition to being a religious leader. Then Muhammad's followers back in Mecca, they get confrontational and argumentative and threatening, and they get chased out of town for disturbing the peace. They are Muslim refugees. They go to Medina, and the Jews are nice. They let them in as Muslim immigrants. And Muhammad allows his followers to rob the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans chasing them out of town. So where Jesus said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt, his attitude was, if they take your house, you retaliate, take their caravan. And so he has 300 warriors, and they rob the caravans. He actually gets a whole chapter of the Quran, Surah 8, Chapter 8, on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. He gets a fifth of the booty. And so in the year 624 AD, the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to protect and escort their caravan, and Muhammad with 300 warriors defeats 1,000 at the Battle of Badr. This amazing victory, having been outnumbered 3-1, convinces Muhammad to be a military leader, and he fights in 66 battles and raids in the next 8 years before he dies. He even used the catapult when he attacked the city of Al-Ta'if. And when he was told the catapult was killing women and children, his response was, they are among them. So they got to be killed too. So suicide bombers and ISIS killers and San Bernardino killers today, they think they're following the example of Muhammad religiously, politically, and militarily. And so we see it's a threefold system, a religious system, a political system, and a military system.
So, Bill, what you're saying is that the Muslim state is different than what we're used to as Americans. We have this democracy. We talk about the separation of religion and state. But I think what I'm hearing you say is there's a long history around these people who follow Muhammad who believe that state and religion are not to be separate. Is that right?
Correct. And again, since Muhammad is the perfect Muslim, his life is called the Sunnah, which means the way or the example. And so true faithful Muslims want to follow his example, religiously, politically, and militarily. But what happened was that the Meccans, in the year 627 AD, their caravans are being robbed. And so they send 10,000 soldiers to Medina to stop Muhammad and his men from robbing their caravans. And turns out Muhammad is a very effective military leader. He's unconventional, creative, unpredictable. His idea of roadside bombs was he dug potholes and trenches all around the city of Medina, which rendered the superior cavalry of the Meccans useless. You can't charge your horses and camels across a field full of potholes and trenches. They'll break their legs. So it throws off the battle strategy. Muhammad goes to some of these pagan tribes at night and bribes them. They slip away. Goes to some of the other pagan tribes at night, threatens them, they slip away, sort of the Chicago politics, the bribe or the bullet. Then it gets freezing cold for a week. The rest of the Meccans lose heart and decide to retreat. And Muhammad is left with the fact that his enemies retreated. And it left a power vacuum, very similar to 2010 when our president declared war in Iraq and Afghanistan over, mission complete, brings all of our troops home, leaves a power vacuum. Did the fundamentalist Muslims suddenly get more peaceful? No, they were actually emboldened and started what John Kerry called a genocide. So in Muhammad's example, when the Meccans retreated, he was emboldened. He went back into the Jewish city, and he gets offended at one of the Jewish tribes and whips the followers into a frenzy. They attack that tribe, confiscate their property, chase them out of town. Then he gets offended at something the second Jewish tribe does and gets his followers into a violent outburst, and they attack that second Jewish tribe, confiscate their property, chase them out of town. This actually set a precedent in Islam called Hudna, H-U-D-N-A, Hudna. It means when you're weak, you make treaties until you get strong enough to disregard them. So when Muhammad first came to Medina, he was this refugee. He organizes, goes to the Jews, they make a treaty with him. Now it's 5 years later, he's just chased away the only people that could come to the Jews' rescue, and he's in a position of strength, and the treaties are broken, and he confiscates those two Jewish tribes' property, chases them out. The third Jewish tribe, Muhammad, bottled them in their neighborhood for 25 days. When they finally surrendered, he brought them out into the market and chopped off the heads of 700 men, sold the women and children into slavery. He did keep one of the wives for himself, Rehana. He went on to have 11 to 22 wives, the youngest being Aisha, the six-year-old. But within 5 years of Muhammad coming as an immigrant into the Jewish city of Medina, there is not a Jew left in the city of Medina. They've been chased out, killed, or enslaved. And within 5 years of his death, every pre-existing culture in Arabia was wiped out. And so again, it's a three-step process, sort of like Caesar's three steps, Veni, Vidi, Vici, I came, I saw, I conquered. Muhammad's was immigrate, increase, eliminate. Immigrate into the host country as a religious refugee. Increase the number of your followers amongst the disadvantaged minorities and then demand political accommodation. And then eliminate the previous civilization until you finally take over, and there's the militancy. And so we see this is repeated over 1,400 years, and it's happening today in Detroit. I was speaking and afterwards visiting with people and was told stories of a lady who had a ministry to pregnant moms, and she shows up at the Muslim house with a present. While she's there, out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom. Out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom. Out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom, all pregnant by the same man. He's practicing Sharia law polygamy in his house in Dearborn, Michigan. And then someone else says, Fazl bought a bunch of houses on the block, put a wife in each one. They go down to the welfare office and say the husband's not around, and they get these checks. And he visits the wives, and the more children they have, the larger the checks get. He's living like a king at state expense. All the kids playing in the middle of the street are his kids. He's practicing Sharia law polygamy on his block in Dearborn, Michigan. Muslims take over several blocks and they vote in the school board. Now they have the girls with their burqas and they have their calls to prayer five times a day in the gymnasiums with the boys at the front, the girls behind them, and the girls having their period are behind them, right? Because it's all this hierarchical. Muhammad said if a dog, a donkey, or a woman passes between you and Mecca when you're praying, your prayers are invalidated. And so this is happening in the public schools in Dearborn, Michigan. Then they take over several more blocks and they vote in the police department, fire department, and now they have their minarets and their calls to prayer five times a day. Like in Hamtramck, Michigan, they now have a majority Muslim city council, and all the former Polish inhabitants of the neighborhoods are driven out. So we see it's this three-step process. You immigrate as a religious refugee, increase your following and demand political accommodation, and then eliminate the previous culture. And there's always that stickler that says, I'm not going to move out. I was raised here. And that's when Muslim youth do random violence. And there's no witnesses because no Muslim family is going to testify against another Muslim family on behalf of some kafir infidel. And so they effectively take over. And so we see this happening in Europe. Europe's an interesting study. It went from a Judeo-Christian past into a secular, free sex, LGBT present. And now Europe's going into an Islamic future. Right, so Europe all used to be Catholic, Protestant, Reformation, Jewish neighborhoods, and then Europe with the French Revolution became secular, and Napoleon spreads it all around. And secular Europe says, hey, bring in whatever you want, any type of sexual morals, any type of beliefs. And so into Europe comes Sharia law Islam and slams a car into reverse and says you can beat your wife, on her, kill your daughter, call Jews apes and pigs. So they're taking over neighborhoods, outlawing Christmas decorations. They're building mosques. And so 10 years ago, there were 3 mosques in Germany. Today, there's over 200. Most of southern Holland is Moroccan Muslim. The number one name for newborns in London, Milan, and Brussels is Mohammed. The number one crime in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark is rape. Muslim immigrant men raping European women because Mohammed permitted his men to rape the women they took in battle. And so there's 5 million Muslims in 700 neighborhoods surrounding Paris. And the best the police can do is put up a sign that says, enter at your own risk. It's ZUS, Zonas Urbanas Sensibles, Sensitive Urban Zone. And so we see Europe has gone from this Judeo-Christian past into this secular, free sex, gay neutral. Now Europe's going into an Islamic future. And so it's a trend. It's observable in history, and it's predictable. And there's 1,400 years of track record. People forget Egypt used to be completely Christian, evangelized by Mark that wrote the gospel, until it was invaded by Amir ibn Alas and his Muslim army. Jerusalem and Syria used to be Christian. Matter of fact, Syria is where the name Christian was first used. It was where the Apostle Paul evangelized until Caliph Umar conquered Syria. And then in the year 711, 80,000 Muslims cross the Strait of Gibraltar and conquer Spain. And they're fighting on horseback with Arabian horses, stirrups, and scimitar swords. Europeans are still fighting on foot. In 10 years, they conquer all of Spain, carry away over 1 million into slavery. There were entire Catholic orders in Europe called the Trinitarians. Head of the order was called the Ransomer. They collect alms and donations and went under a white flag to North Africa to get your friend back. But then in the year 732 AD, the Muslims had crossed the Pyrenees Mountains and they're finally stopped outside of Paris at the Battle of Tours just 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 AD. Had Charles Martel, he was the grandfather of Charlemagne, had he not stopped the Muslims at the Battle of Tours, we would be speaking Arabic right now because German, French, English, and Spanish would have never developed as languages. We'd be like Egypt where the Coptic Egyptian language was eradicated by the Arabic language. And it took 700 years to drive the Muslims out of Spain. Then they come around the other side and there's a second spring called the Turkish Spring. And so the Turks in two waves, Seljuk Turks, Ottoman Turks, they invade into what is today Turkey. But back then, it was the Byzantine Christian Empire. All 7 churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were wiped out by the Muslim Turks. All these letters that New Testament writers like the Apostle Paul, wrote to, those Ephesus, Colossae, Galatia, those cities were conquered by the Muslim Turks. The Greek Christians begged the Catholic West for help. The West sends help. It's called the Crusades. So Muslims have 14 centuries of Crusades. Europeans only had 2 centuries. When the Crusades end, the Muslims pick up and they invade into Europe, and they finally conquer Constantinople in the year 1453. Why is that significant? Because this ends land trade routes to get from Europe to India and China. People forget 2 centuries earlier, Marco Polo went from Venice, Italy to China, brings back to Europe spaghetti noodles, gunpowder, thread from worms, silkworms, China plates. Talked about the Chinese inventing the piñata, the wheelbarrow, the compass, the Pony Express, and paper from tree pulp rather than from papyrus reeds, and they printed the first paper currency. China was technologically superior to Europe, and India had teas, dyes, and spices. And there was trade across the Gobi Desert, the China Silk Road, until the Muslims conquered Central Asia and then sacked Constantinople in 1453. And so the Europeans began to look for a sea route. So in 1492, Columbus set sail west. He runs into some islands. He thinks he's in India. So he names the people the Indians. Think of it. Columbus would have never set sail over here if it had not been for an Islamic jihad setting up their ISIS, their Islamic State, their caliphate over there. And we would never have called Native Americans Indians if it was not for Islamic jihad, because Columbus gave him that name because he thought he was an Indian. And then the Muslims dominated the Mediterranean Sea, and they controlled North Africa, the Middle East, Greece, Turkey. They were invading the coast of Italy. Matter of fact, in the year 846 AD, 11,000 Muslims invaded Rome and trashed the bones of St. Peter and St. Paul. It was after that that Pope Leo decided to build the wall around the Vatican. And there were whole coasts of Italy where there was not a woman of childbearing age for generations, because the Muslim pirates would come up like Boko Haram and kidnap the women, take them away. And so finally, they surround Vienna, Austria in 1529, 100,000 Muslims under Suleiman the Magnificent. Well, Martin Luther had started the Reformation just 12 years earlier. And he said, the Turk is the rod of the wrath of the Lord our God. If the Turk's God, the devil, is not beaten first, or is reason to fear, the Turk will not be so easy to beat. The fight against the Turks must begin with repentance. We must reform our lives, or God will give us into the hands of the devil and the Turk. Anyway, the Holy Roman Emperor is Charles V of Spain, most powerful guy in the world. He controls Spain, the Spanish Netherlands, Italy, Austria, countries in Germany, and then he controls the New World. The Philippines are named after his son, King Philip of Spain. So Charles V, being Catholic, is faced with a double dilemma. Protestant Reformation on one hand, Muslim invasion on the other hand. So Charles V decides to strike a deal with the Protestants in the year 1555. It's called the Treaty of Augsburg. And in this treaty is a little Latin phrase that had enormous repercussions. What was the phrase? Cuius regio, eius religio, which means whose is the reign, his is the religion. In other words, look, Protestant king, believe whatever you want in your kingdom. Let's just work together against these Muslims who are invading Europe because they want to kill us all. And it worked, but it started a domino effect in the next century. So instead of all Europe being Catholic, now different kings could believe what they wanted, and they believed different things. So England became Anglican, Scotland Presbyterian, Holland Dutch Reformed, Northern Germany and Sweden Lutheran, Switzerland Calvinist, Italy, Spain, Greece, Austria was Catholic, and Greece was Greek Orthodox, Russia was Russian Orthodox, and you get the picture. Anyways, one denomination per country in Europe, and if you didn't believe the way your king did, you were persecuted, you fled, and these were the people that eventually spilled over and founded colonies in America. And so again, we see that as Islam encroaches from the east, civilization spreads to the west. And it's a fascinating study. We see that in the year 1625, pilgrims that founded Plymouth in Massachusetts, they had saved up 800 pounds of beaver skins and sent them back to England for trade. And William Bradford writes that a Turkish man of war, a pirate ship, captures them in the English Channel, takes them to Morocco, and sells them into slavery. And so in the year 1635, the Muslims attacked Ireland, and they carried away an entire village, the stolen village of Baltimore, Ireland. They rounded them all up, put them on ships, took them to Morocco, sold them into slavery. And around 1640, they captured 400 from Reykjavik, Iceland, and they rounded them up, put them on ships, took them to Morocco, sold them into slavery. And so what happened was that instead of going through these Catholic orders of Trinitarians and so forth, the countries of Europe would pay an annual tribute. England, Spain, France would pay millions of dollars to these Muslim pirates. And that was the dynamic until America breaks away from Britain with our Revolutionary War. And the Muslims of Morocco said, well, you mean you're not part of Britain anymore? No, we're an independent country. Ah, that means you need to pay up. and they began to capture American ships, stick our crews in the dungeons of Algiers, Tunis, and Tripoli. That's when Thomas Jefferson gets fed up and sends in the Marines. And we get the Marine anthem from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. And we begin to see that after the old defeat of the Muslims at the Battle of Vienna, 1683, September 11th, the Ottoman Empire began to shrink till finally after World War I, the Ottoman Empire was gone. And there was this era of peace, of nonviolence. The Muslim world, their empire that had existed from 1071 AD up until 1923, it was gone. And so the Muslim world was ruled by these leaders who were secular, who thought that, well, the future is the West. So Britain had ruled the world for two centuries. America had won World War I, World War II. And so the Muslim leaders would dress in business suits, send their kids to Western schools, teach English in their country, sort of like the Shah of Iran. And it was moving in this westerly direction until the Muslim Brotherhood was started in 1928. And they began to target these secular leaders, saying, stop making friends with the infidels. The West would prop up these secular leaders until oil was discovered in 1938 by Standard Oil Company in Saudi Arabia. And now they've got money and clout. They begin to buy politicians, buy their influence. We began to see things like Nixon and Kissinger during the Vietnam War turned a blind eye to 2.5 million Hindus being killed by the Muslims in 1971. We saw Jimmy Carter abandoning our ally, the Shah, to the fundamentalist Ayatollah. I loved Reagan, but when the Muslims blew up the U.S. Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1983, his response was to, you know, even though 241 U.S. Marines were killed, his response was just to leave. And then we began to see more and more of us backing away and creating this power vacuum. And it was emboldening them more and more until our new president. And he fires our ally, Mubarak, in Egypt and allows Morsi, a Muslim Brotherhood leader, to take over Egypt. And then our president takes out Gaddafi, the leader of Libya. We were not at war with Libya, yet our president decided to knock off the leader of a country. Why? So the Muslim Brotherhood can take over Libya. And then we're seeing that the guns were being moved from Libya to arm the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria to take out the leader of Syria. But when Assad comes, when Russia comes to Assad's rescue, these Muslim Brotherhood people, armed by America and trained, start calling themselves ISIS and begin to kill Christians with American guns. And then our president lets five Muslim Brotherhood go from Guantanamo Bay in exchange for a defector. And then we see that we rush through funding to train good Muslims to fight bad Muslims. They get armed and trained. They join ISIS. And it's just one of these situations that goes on and on. But it's important for us to know this history.
I'll say. It really is. So, Bill, what an amazing, dramatic, kind of scary history. And the average person here in North America would say, well, that's over there and that's back then. But right here and now, we're in a different place. We're a Christian nation and people just amalgamate in. And we got moderate Muslims because we've got Christ. You know, that maybe that kind of an attitude is in some people's minds. Can you compare, it might help us compare Muhammad and Christ. Are they very similar?
Well, it's interesting because people say, well, we're all worshiping the same God. Well, the largest religion in the world is Christianity, about 33%. The second largest religion in the world is Islam, about 22%. And people say, well, Muslims kill people, Christians kill people. It's sort of a wash. Well, my response is, rather than looking at the followers, let's look at the founders. You know, if your computer acts up, what do? You reload the software the way it was when it left the factory. If your religion acts up, what do? You go back to the way it was when it left the founder. So let's compare the founders. Jesus never killed anybody. Muhammad killed an estimated 3,000 people, including cutting off the heads of 700 Jews in Medina. Jesus never owned slaves. Muhammad got a fifth of the slaves in battle. He actually owned African slaves because he was an Arab. Jesus never tortured anyone. When Muhammad conquered Kaibar, the last Jewish settlement in Arabia, the chief refused to tell where the tribe's treasure was hidden. Muhammad had him stretched out on the ground, and they kindled a fire on his chest. He still wouldn't tell. Muhammad had him beheaded. Jesus didn't allow his disciples to rape anyone. Duh. Muhammad did, and there's always hadiths that talk about how to do it. Jesus never forced anyone to follow him. He said something difficult. Many disciples walked with him no more. Muhammad said, whoever changes his Islamic religion, kill him. Jesus never married. Muhammad had 11 to 22 wives, slave wives, concubines, and so forth. Jesus forgave insults. He's dying on the cross saying, Father, forgive him. Muhammad avenged insults. A guy named Ibn Qatal had made up poems making fun of Muhammad, and so Muhammad ordered him murdered. Jesus called God our Father. In Islam, it is blasphemy to call Allah your Father. Jesus said that we're children of God. In Islam, it's blasphemy to call yourself a child of Allah, because Allah took no wife and has no son. Jesus taught that we're made in the image of God. In Islam, Allah has no image. Jesus taught to have a personal relationship with God. In Islam, it's blasphemy to even want to have a personal relationship with Allah, because he is transcendent and unknowable. The first 3 centuries of Christianity, there were 10 major persecutions. Christians were thrown to the lions. They never led an armed resistance against the Roman emperor. The first 3 centuries of Islam, they conquered from Arabia to Paris. Jesus said, preach the gospel, and if a town does not receive you, shake the dust from your feet and depart. Muhammad said, go to a town and offer them peace. If they submit to Allah, you grant them peace, and if they don't, you subdue them. We see that Jesus did not allow his disciples to lie. He said, I am the way, the truth, and life. And of course, the Bible, Proverbs says, 6 things the Lord hates, a proud look, a lying tongue. And he said that you're of Satan, that he was the father of liars. And the book of Revelation says that he that loveth and maketh a lie will not enter the New Jerusalem. Well, Muhammad permitted lying. It's called taqiyya, sacred lying, holy deceit. Muslims are obligated to lie to help advance Islam. And so there was a story of a chieftain planning on attacking Muhammad. And he goes to his warriors and he said, who will rid me of this chieftain? His one warrior said, I will if you permit me to lie. Muhammad said, go. So the warrior goes to the chieftain and says, I've left Muhammad. He's a heretic. I want to help you, but they're after me. And the chieftain says, okay, you can spend the night in my tent. You'll have my whole army surrounding you. You'll be safe. Well, in the middle of the night, the warrior tiptoes over and beheads the chieftain, grabs his head, runs all the way, gives it to Muhammad. And Muhammad gives him his staff and said, you can lean on this in the day of judgment, because on that day, many people won't have anything to lean upon. Muhammad approved of lying to your infidel enemy so that you can gain the advantage and behead them. Another story, a Muslim warrior was captured and forced to renounce Muhammad. He escaped, went back to Muhammad, and Muhammad forgave him and said, if they make you turn, turn, but don't turn in your heart. In other words, it's okay to deny Muhammad in a pinch to save your skin as long as you don't fight against Islam. In other words, it's okay to say you're not a Muslim in order to get elected, but then everything you do once you're elected is to help advance Islam. Mm. And then we see people say, well, we're all worshiping the same God. Well, let's see. The largest religion, Christianity, says that you believe that Jesus died on the cross, paid for all of your sins, you go to heaven. In Islam, they have an unforgivable sin called shirk, S-H-I-R-K, shirk. And they say that if you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, you have committed the unforgivable sin called shirk that condemns you to hell. So question, if we're all worshiping the same God, how can the same God say, if you believe in Jesus, you go up, and if you believe in Jesus, you go down? Either God is schizophrenic or we're talking about two different gods.
This was originally a one-hour broadcast. To hear the recording in its entirety, please go to scriptureawakening.com.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. And Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. Visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com, where you can download free podcasts of all Beyond Words programs.